Welcome to the Month End, a CPG community chat. The Month End will provide emerging CPG brands real-life knowledge into the accounting, finance, and operational worlds. Our guests will be key stakeholders from those same brands, as well as other key contributors to the industry, all of which have vast experiences and insights that will be shared with the audience. Welcome to episode 21 of the Month End. Today's guest is Jeremy Cohen from the Yes Bar. What's up, Jeremy?
Hey, what's up, Brad?
Hey, Jeremy's the co-founder and partner in the Yes Bar. Why don't you give us a little background on the Yes Bar, what you guys are, what you sell, where you are, and then we can kind of get into your background and everything. Jeremy, I'm really excited to have you on the chat today.
Yeah, we're really excited to join you as well. And so the Yes Bar started out of love in Abigail's kitchen. A lot of these food stories are personal, and her children struggled with food allergies and sensitivities. And, you know, they were like bringing coolers of like cooked lentils and, you know, quinoa to the birthday party. And the kids were on this really restrictive diet. And it was really tough. You know, kids want to eat birthday cake with their friends. They want that experience. And so she, in this kind of moment of challenge, went into her cupboard and pulled out all the good things she could think of: macadamia nuts, almonds, organic maple syrup, coconut butter, tahini, pumpkin seeds. And she basically created this treat for her kids in a moment of like turning a negative into a positive and giving them something that they could enjoy, feel like they weren't super restricted on their diet. And that's where the Yes Bar comes from. That's the name, like saying yes. And it's kind of an affirmation. It's kind of finding that moment of positivity. And that's the genesis, is that recipe too, right? Like, we use four different kinds of nuts: almonds, macadamia nuts, cashews, pecans. We just added a new nut, walnut, that we're doing on a new flavor. So we stay away from grains. There's no dairy, there's no soy. And we try to kind of have like a low glycemic, clean, you know, it's like anti-inflammatory approach with our bars. But at the end of the day, like, we're really about taste and ingredients. And I think it's something where people have always said it's a little crazy to make a bar the way that we do, especially in a set as crowded as bars are. We've got all these premium ingredients, and a lot of people thought we're nuts to make this bar. And we just really believed that this is a special product and that people really deserve, you know, something that's really special that comes from this place, and that we've worked super, super hard over the last number of years just trying to make this and grow it and, you know, get it to as many people as possible.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. I mean, I have children, we go to birthday parties and cupcakes. Yeah. It's tough keeping them healthy. So anything that can keep kids, you know, healthy and feeling good, as well as having a good taste, is good. People said you're nuts. You said yeah. People said you're nuts. So that's what literally and figuratively nuts you guys are.
I think it's true. Yeah, like we're nuts, and it matters. You know, it's like it's who we are, and I think like look, you got to be a little nuts to start a food company. And you have to have a real passion and desire to, you know, be of service and try to take care of people, whatever that vision is. And that's informed us since the moment that Abigail like made this in her kitchen, and, you know, continues to inform us. Like, we absolutely stay committed to like making sure we're not compromising on ingredients, you know, which obviously over the last few years, especially, it gets more and more challenging to continue to provide that level of ingredient. Yeah. But we keep doing it. Like, we think that that's, you know, who we are and what people deserve. And it's what sets us apart.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to getting more details. So
yeah,
a couple of things. So as we start, like, you know, you have three partners, right? You, Abigail, yeah, and Brennan. So can you kind of help us understand like what you do, like how, yeah, you guys segmented your duties between kind of three, you know, co-founders and partners? Because a lot of times brands don't have three people that are in the core operations as you guys, yeah, have been or on.
You know, in the beginning, Abigail was really involved. She basically had this vision, and she knew that like as a mom, it was really hard for her to kind of take this to that next stage and try to bring this product to people. That's where Brennan and I came in, and we had a background in, you know, food and distribution, and Brennan in private equity as well. So we sort of said, okay, like, we think that this is something to believe in, and we threw all of ourselves into it. she was very involved in that beginning of like setting us up to kind of take control and work together. I would say now she's definitely more, she's still involved. She's the kind of the creative heart of the company. She still helps us like reach out to folks, and you know, was really instrumental as we worked through this like packaging redesign. She's one of those people who's like a serial entrepreneur, you know? So like her creative juices are always flowing, and it's good to have that input and balance. Like that's where the bar kind of came from. It did come from there. And Brennan and I are running more of the day-to-day stuff, you know? And, I would say I'm more on like the operations side. Just working with our co-packer, our warehouse, shipping and fulfillment, logistics. I also kind of have always taken the Amazon program on and kind of built that up as we've been focused on that since kind of around 2016, 2017 when we started working with them. And then Brennan is just like he's the CEO, but he's our leader, like just a sales ninja and business development. And you know, he's someone who is just helping us always just open up these partnerships. And also, I mean, look, we wear a lot of hats. Both of us do all those things too. So I think those are the strengths of the team. And I think like, you know, having listened to your other podcasts, like it's important that you have, if there's partners and people, like a good balance of, you know, talents and ability to work together. And I think with us three, we just like, if you could make a complete person out of the three of us, we would be like great. And so it works really well as we're building the company.
Yeah, sounds like you guys are very complimentary. There's a lot of small brands, I guess, where you guys decided to kind of grow your business, I think more organically, I would say, in regards to not taking a ton of money, hiring 10 people, growing sales teams. So kind of walk us through the approach that you guys have done, especially the last kind of 2-3 years, right? And kind of your growth plan, plus kind of, you know, you guys do wear a lot of hats, and how do you kind of manage that from a pure time capacity standpoint, right? And when is the next time to hire or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, like listening to other brands, you know, there are people that are incredibly dialed in on brand vision, that raise money, that built these teams. And, you know, we've really kind of done things in a completely different way. I think for us, like our motto has always been, when other people zig, we try to zag. And that also comes from the fact that, you know, Brennan and I met working at like a kind of a boutique early stage food distributor. So we were taking brands that were like Abigail's, and that's actually how we met her. These really passionate early stage food companies. At the time, this was like about 10 years ago now, that you incubated in Whole Foods. Like that was the way that brands, food brands launch. You know, you'd make a regional introduction and you'd go from there. And we had a front row seat to sort of the challenges of like UNFI and KeHE and like these bigger, you know, the cost of doing business with these retailers and distributors. And so when we took over, we've always had a bootstrapped approach, and we basically did direct wholesale across the country. We worked with like Earth Bar, Equinox, you know, yoga studios. We tried to go direct, you know, we worked with like we went to Netflix headquarters and office and food service. And we tried to kind of cut out the middleman because our product was the focus. It was all about like product quality, and we still haven't raised any money. So for us, like, you know, 6-7 years into this, we've done things a lot differently. And there are moments where I think like it would be nice to have a little bit more support, and we're trying to kind of build that out and bring in those layers. But it's also allowed us, as we built this different model, it's like a hybrid distribution model where we go direct, we kind of control the distribution. Before COVID, we were in about 2,000 to 3,000 little accounts across the country as far as doors went. Our business shifted. We had to kind of become more of a direct consumer company to kind of weather that storm. But it's certainly like, it's definitely like to not be in a grocery store or a major grocery chain, and to have kind of the revenue that we have and the traction, it's really not something that's conventional. It's not something you see.
No, it did definitely, from our kind of vast other clients in the CPG world, like, you know, we typically don't see this. So it's interesting seeing them and it comes to fruition of just you know, the different situations or models or growth, you know, plans that people have, any one of them can work as long as they're applied properly. So from an aspect of kind of you know, I guess, you know, looking from a sales channel standpoint, yeah, for kind of addressing that. So, you know, the sales channels that you guys were in or what you're in now, and kind of, you know, from my understanding, there's a lot, you know, there, you know, clearly there's a ton of reselling sites and things like that. Like, what have you found what works? What do you like? What do you see coming, you know, down the pipe, or, you know, where YesBar will be continued consistently?
Yeah. I mean, for us, like, that was our early stage model. That was how we kind of scrappily built the company. And when COVID hit, obviously everyone left offices and no one was in yoga studios and people, you know, that whole model shifted. And we were very lucky. For years, we'd been in touch with, we built our Amazon business, which is its own sort of focus of ours. Like, that's our D2C channel that we excel in. And then we were very lucky to build some partnerships with, you know, the incredible people at like Imperfect Foods, Thrive Market. We work with Misfits Markets, another great partner of ours. They're incredible. Like these great grocery direct programs. We started with Good Eggs a long time ago. They believed in us, you know, before anybody did, when we were a small local brand. And we found, like, kind of reaching consumers on the digital grocery shelf for us, it allowed us to stand out a little bit more. You know, at our core, like, we're a sales and product company. Like, that's what we focus on. Like, all of our focus is on making the best product and trying to sell that product. And I think a lot of companies have that same calculus, but we don't, you know, we didn't do a lot of marketing, and we didn't want to go into a wall of bars, right? Like, we knew that the barriers to entry into those traditional channels, with a product like ours, with the ingredient costs, we were going to be retailing at such a high price point, and we would not have any sort of ACV. Like, our velocity would have just been, we could have done, you know, some pipeline fills and gone into those stores, but it would have sat there. And so, you know, for us, building that sales velocity, opening up the right partnerships, like, going digital, going direct, it helped us establish our brand in a way that allowed us to also be focused on, like, a high cost of goods, ingredient, and product profile. Like, it kind of helped us scale in a way that allowed us to, like, not have to raise money and not have to be as capital intensive, because we were sort of going direct to the people.
Yeah, love it. So then how do you handle your kind of reporting from a sales channel standpoint? What KPIs, financials, metrics, yep, do you look at within, you know, Amazon and some of your bigger sales channels and platforms?
I know, like, I'm talking about how we're different. I'm going to sound like a financial dinosaur here, but, like, we're big believers in EBITDA, which I think is a funny thing to say, right?
Like, it's hilarious.
I think people 20, 30 years ago, when they were writing in paper spreadsheets, would have cared about EBITDA. And now it's like, you know, it's growth or it's doors or whatever it is. And, you know, we believe in profit. Like, for us, we're trying to build in a profitable way. We've been very fortunate to have an advisor come on board, Michael Namey, who's the former CEO of Tate's Cookies. And that's how they built their business. I mean, they never raised money. Now, they own their manufacturing co-packing, which I think is a different kind of calculation. But we come from that school of thought of, like, okay, can we grow profitably? Can we reinvest in our brand? Can we understand, you know, really understand our COGS and our profit margins in these channels and say, okay, like, where can we get to in a good EBITDA number? And can we keep kind of building on that in a sustainable way? It's not glamorous, and it definitely takes more time to do things that way, but we're a big believer in that.
It's fantastic. For the listeners, EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So you can always reach out to Jeremy and he'll, you know, give you more thesis on that. anyways, no, I think that's fantastic. I think the last handful of years, just in terms of how media and the markets portray, not just in CPG, but, like, tech stocks and, you know, growth and valuations and raising money. It's like, does anybody ever talk about profits? They never talk about profits.
No.
It's bizarre. So yeah. I do feel like at some point it's going to swing back to that, of just people like, all right, maybe let's just build a sustainable business where, yeah, we don't need to reinvest, you know, or get money into the business every 12 months or 18 months to keep it growing. So yeah, kudos to you guys. You know, as an accountant, I love hearing that. And I definitely can see that you guys are kind of, you know, that goal of yours is actually, you know, coming to fruition. So good work on all that. So Moving on to kind of, you know, like now that we're moving profits, let's move to kind of cash flow, operational, supply chain. So number one, supply chain clearly has changed dramatically the last couple of years with COVID. So give an update on your supply chain, some challenges, kind of, you know, shortages and just supplies, kind of, you know, how things have changed the last couple of years with COVID and kind of what's going on the last, you know, economically the last 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, like I don't think these storm clouds are going to clear. You know, we keep sort of looking over the horizon. And I think when it was early in COVID, we were like, hey, let's just get through the next quarter or 6 months. And I think what it demands of entrepreneurs and business owners is that you're going to have to kind of have an assumption, not an assumption, but an understanding that this is kind of the new normal. And that there's just, it seems to me that there's kind of like rolling challenges with supply chain. At the beginning of COVID, there was a lot of like, you know, port congestion and things and availability with that stuff. Like at one point, we had to air freight our chocolate in because it would have sat on like a container at a port for 2 months. So this price of our chocolate spiked 30%, you know, overnight on one of our core ingredients. And then it moved to like, you know, trucking issues. And now there's diesel and fuel issues, and there's now getting the ingredients. It's a fuel cost, and the fuel inputs are really challenging. I think the consumer is starting to soften a little bit, and which is also its own set of challenges. And then I'm looking forward and I'm seeing, like, you know, if fertilizer input costs are where they're at, coming up on this next round of like growth in the agricultural sector, I think we're going to see another bump kind of near the second half of this year based on like those input costs. Mm-hmm. And so it's just been like kind of one thing after the other. For us, we're very lucky that we have a really good relationship with our co-packer. We've been able to grow and scale with them during this time, which certainly helps a lot. If you can grow those volumes, that helps kind of blunt the like rising costs. You know, and we've been working on contract pricing on ingredients that we can identify, you know, that it makes sense to kind of have a contract and pull from and pull to our co-packer. I think it's a combination of all those things. I think you got to stay on your toes. I don't see it calming down anytime soon. And I'm hopeful that like we can continue to grow, and offer, you know, our margins are starting to get more challenging right now. But we're probably one of the only brands that hasn't raised prices yet during COVID. I mean, we could, and I'm trying to hold it off for as long as it's humanly possible. I wanted to try to continue to grow and see if that's the ability that we have as a company to continue to deliver that value. But yeah, it's growth, it's planning. And hopefully you can just own that relationship with your co-packer.
Yeah, the co-packer relationship is so key, especially during these times. How, you know, in relation to your co-packer years ago when you created relationships, like you guys have, you know, the yes bar, right? So you have only a specific set of ingredients, high quality, you have that kind of minimum quality and requirement. Like, how did you go about identifying that co-ban? Have you had any issues with that? What would you recommend to somebody? Because clearly, like, a lot of people are gluten-free these days, but when you add on six different things like you guys, it's even more, right?
Yeah. We had some relationships going back with our co-manufacturer. Originally, when Abigail started the company, the owners of our current co-manufacturer were doing it in another small facility. And she knew them, and we knew them going into that relationship. We've only worked with a few co-packers in our 7 years, and we've been with our current co-packer for the last four. We started with them in 2018. It was, you know, tremendously difficult for us to scale and like try to figure out how to manufacture our bars with them. They were a really good partner helping us learn and grow. Like in the beginning for us, it was really like, how do we continue to grow those yields and continue to scale that product up? There was times where like we had to go through different machines, different processes. There was a point where like our machines would break down early in production. And so we would fly down once a month and we would spend 22 hours in the kitchen. So we would do a double shift with each manufacturing shift that came in, and we would be there. And by the end of it, we'd have to hand scoop our bars and put them in a former and press them. And like, it's just a wild sort of situation. Like you really have to be kind of have that determination as you're, I know that not everyone's going to have that nightmare scenario, but what I'm saying is like, we had to work through a lot of that stuff and we wouldn't take no for an answer. And then eventually we found the right machinery that allowed us to sort of grow those yields a lot, like really jump up on the production scale of things. And that's, you know, I'm glad we got through that. I would never want to go back to that point. So I think it's, can you find someone who's going to be a partner for you? It's not always just about price, and it's not always, sometimes it's not even just about the supply chain. It's about like, can you get into that production environment? It's always going to be challenging. Like that's probably the worst case scenario that you're going to get. But every time I go into a co-manufacturing facility, I kind of have like a PTSD kick in. I'm kind of like, you know, everything that can go wrong in that environment is going to go wrong. You got to be able to manage it. You have to be able to kind of keep pushing through. And that's like, we learned the hard way, but it would help to have a good partner that like helped us through that process for sure.
Yeah, definitely to be engaged in that process. That's just hilarious and envisioning 22-hour days around here.
Yeah.
But anyways, you know, related to inventory, right? So inventory is basically cash, right? It's a cash outlet. So then, and you know, managing that the time you have inventory at hand at your end before you sell it, you know, minimizes the cash kind of cycle there. So how do you manage cash in relation to inventory buying and planning? And what's that process look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be super candid. Like our inventory purchasing, basically we have to put down a deposit for 50% of the production about 6 weeks before the production run. So we're basically securing, in a sense, like we're paying up front. We have upfront cash that's going out in addition to, you know, the production stuff that's happening with the co-packer. On one hand, it helps to take that sort of sourcing off. There was a point in time where I was, you know, managing our supply chain and, you know, making phone calls to nut suppliers and trying to do all that. So that's great. But it definitely, like, our cash conversion cycle starts 6 weeks before we run the bars. And then, you know, there could be probably another 45 days. I got to take a look at the reports, you know, like what that's coming down to. That cash can sit there, you know, in the business for a long period of time. For us, like, there was really nothing that we could do given that system. We just had to keep selling and managing it to the best of our ability. And we just tried to take all the data we had from a sales perspective and tailor our POs the right way. And then, you know, in the beginning, since we didn't raise money, we were trying to figure out how to get working capital to handle those timelines. Those timelines haven't changed. Like that sort of same scenario, that's holding true now, to where we're depositing in that time frame. And so like we're having to plan in a way that absorbs that, basically.
Yeah, you definitely have to be involved day to day, week over week, especially in a world you didn't raise a ton of money. So it's week over week changes, you know, dramatically. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So when you're looking at like, let's say with monthly financials come over to you, like what is the top two things you look at on the financials?
I mean, again, like I'm trying to look at that profit number and trying to drill down as to what's driving that. And I think what your team has done incredibly well for us. What I didn't understand, I thought our books, we had invested a lot of time to try to get our books to a better place before we came to you guys. And I realized that there was a lot more that we could be doing once we started onboarding with you. And now that we're at the point that we are, and I think specifically like class and trade, like when you're looking at, because we have kind of unique classes of trade. Like we do direct wholesale, we have DDC, we have Amazon, which is really tough when it comes to sort of the billing structure that occurs there. And so it's not like we have like one big distributor that's taking all this, that it's a lot easier to understand that class top to bottom. Your team's come in and helped us like kind of look at the different pillars of the business and say, okay, like where the cogs are at, what's happening in each of those classes of business, and how can we maybe see, do we shift some resources to one or the other, or are margins looking more challenged with Amazon or with wholesale? Those are the things that I'm looking at every month now when that comes through. And, you know, your team's been great to try to help us understand where those numbers are coming from.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. Number one. Number two is, I think the key is especially how a lot of those sites and just how they deposit money net of plus the timing of it. So a lot of times the key of really understanding the numbers, it comes down to basically matching the expenses and grossing up sales and everything in that specific month or time frame, which a lot of it's hard to do if you don't have kind of the experience plus just the time to do it. So you can see that net amount raising every month, deposit every 2 weeks from Amazon, but until you're really back on your advertising fees, your fulfillment fees, your discounts and all this stuff, you don't see kind of the true, you know, contribution margin, operating profit margin percentage that matters, right? So you can see the top line growing, but it comes differently. So
you put it way better than I did, Brad.
There we go. That's what I did. A company like you guys that are focused on, you know, profits, you have to kind of deep dive into individual classes and even customers to understand what's going on there. So love it. I was trying to trick you to see if you were going to be like, well, look at top line revenue. And I was like, thank you.
I'm old school. I can come by the office and fit in with your crew, you know?
Well, the account was growing, so you can come. Anyways,
that'd be great.
Good stuff. And then from a, you know, clearly profits of a sales channel, but also like, how do you look at like, you know, you guys, you're talking about like your product and sale company. So like from the sales side, like how do you guys do, look at not just profits of that kind of sales channel or site, but like, you know, customer acquisition costs, you know, lifetime value, like how do you guys analyze that or look at that, especially as you're kind of very conscious of your margins at each sales channel?
Yeah. And like, I think when I say D2C, our business is mainly in the Amazon channel. From what I've seen, those costs are really prohibitive with where those revenue streams are for our business, like in D2C on our website. And like, especially with where you're looking at, you know, with the iOS updates and how things change now, those costs to acquire customers are much higher. And they're much higher on Amazon too. We have a fairly conservative Amazon strategy when it comes to advertising. For us, like, I think we're trying to really understand the nuts and bolts of like costs and profit of those channels. We're not doing a ton of advertising. Like when we're setting margin for like a business or a channel, like we're trying, it's kind of a gut decision, but we're also really looking at those numbers and saying, you know, the channel pricing and where's that retail going to land? And we're hopeful that like, you know, those people are going to be engaged enough to buy. And that's why those platforms like thrive. We do a lot of marketing support in certain platforms. Like those are people where we're reaching them and we know, okay, like if you're doing like a, you know, whatever the X number of dollars for a program that month is, like, it's hard to get that data on a customer basis, but we do see like when you back it out and we see a month over month, like we can really see the effect those dollars have. We don't get as granular with like, you know, Facebook digital marketing. We don't, that's just not our model. We try to stay a little bit more conservative with our marketing and we try to like support our partners. You know, for some of our partners like Imperfect Foods, we try to give them a better price. Like, you know, they're not doing marketing as much marketing on their platform. So we're saying, okay, can we work with you so that the retail for the customer is in a good spot? Which I think is another thing. Like, I know, again, like I'm going to sound sort of old school in the way that people think about companies and all of these metrics, but it's like, you know, you can spend money doing those things. For us, we want to get people a product at a good price. Like we want people to be able to buy that product, enjoy it, not feel like it's something that's out of their reach. And so we've stayed a little more lean on those inputs in order to kind of reach the market at a better price point.
Very cool. Very cool. Unit economics kind of looked at it a little bit differently. And yeah, like, you know, people to enjoy the product and want to come back because they're not just stressed out about the cost of it all. So, you know, clearly the way the environment is today, you know, cost is very sensitive, or people are very sensitive to cost. So while we're wrapping this up, I got, you know, our typical kind of two ending questions, which we'll get into, and then we can discuss kind of, you know, what you guys have on the horizon come up front. Yeah. So as we get into this, give us, give the listeners one industry do.
One industry do. I think it's super important as an entrepreneur and, a, you know, an owner of a company to try to do every process that you are going to hire for or invest in, try to do that on your own for a little bit. I mean, we maybe have done that to our detriment for too long in some cases, but I also think it's really valuable. Like I've done, you know, I've managed 3PLs. I've tried, you know, dipped my toes in Amazon advertising. I've done, you know, I've been in the co-manufacturing kitchen. If you can own those pieces of the business, even in the beginning, when you're like really lean and you're trying to learn and grow, you're going to be able to identify, I think, people that you can either hire or bring in to help in a much better way. You're going to understand those processes better. Knowing that like we've been involved in almost every aspect of our business, I know I'm not an expert at any one of those things, but I also feel much more well-equipped to look at, you know, look at those pieces of the business and bring someone in and know, okay, like this is the strategy and I've been in that position and I've done some of that stuff. So, you know, try to learn and try to do as much as you can, especially in the beginning. You have an opportunity to do that before you can bring in more resources.
Yeah, I echo that. It's much easier to write the job responsibility, like, you know, list when you've done it or yeah. had a little bit of process. So, you know, definitely agree on that one. All right. What is it? One industry don't.
You know, we as you've heard, like we've been unconventional when it comes to our growth. And so, you know, it was hard for us to get capital, right? Like banks wouldn't lend to us. We were too small. And we tried to find kind of alternative sources of financing. And we have worked with an amazing team over at Circle Up doing some stuff on the you know, the credit financing side. They were the first people to do it for us. But we also made some mistakes working with factoring companies, which I want to like caution people. They're good companies. They're good people out there. If it works for you, great. But that fee structure, that 2% or 3%, when you amortize it as an APR over an entire year, it's 24%, it's 28%. You know, it's we needed capital at certain points, but we didn't have a choice. But I would just caution folks to be mindful when it comes to like the inventory financing and the factoring and that sort of stuff, because it can get to be expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. The key is the number looks small, but once you times it, to get it to a 12-month period, you're like, wait, what?
It's crazy. It's
pretty pricey. Well, yeah. Awesome. This was great, Jeremy. Like, I really appreciate your time. I really
yeah.
insight in kind of the non-traditional way of looking at a business, which is super totally. Cool. What is new for the Yes Bar? What's on the horizon? New brands, new, like, what do you got going on? New products? What do you got going on?
Yeah. So this last year, we launched, we're on JetBlue Airlines in the snack box. So you can find us on JetBlue, dark chocolate chip bars. We're super excited about that partnership. We are sending in our first orders to REI this week. So we're launching nationally with REI. And then the big thing is we are finishing new branding and packaging. So this is the new look of our bars. If you compare it to, I brought the old bar too. So you can kind of see like it's a very cleaned up look. We've got two exciting new flavors coming, peanut butter dark chocolate with sea salt and apple cinnamon crisp, which is my personal favorite. We do it with like a golden raisin and a dried apple. It's like, it tastes like apple pie. We're super excited about these new products. We've got a new website coming as well with all of this. So we're just hoping to keep getting people really good food and kind of staying product focused, trying to get people the best possible snack that they can have as a bar.
Awesome. And what's your where can people go find it and buy it?
Yeah, I mean, we're available. We have some great like bulk deals on our website for people to order into your home. If you're working from home is a hub. We also have Amazon is a great option for us, and you can find us kind of out in the world a little bit. Still, it's hard to find us, but you know, always feel free to reach out to us. We can tell you if there's something near you as far as a retailer, and when we'll always go above and beyond for you.
And that's yesbar.com?
Yesbar.com, that's right.
Pretty easy to remember.
There it is.
Well, awesome. Jeremy, again, this was great. I think the listeners will get a good some good information and some different ways of thinking about kind of running a CPG brand. So appreciate you. Kudos and best wishes to Yes Bar in 2022 and moving forward.
We really appreciate you guys. Such a great partner. I should have also said, you know, big piece of advice, work with Accountfully. we could have done that 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, really appreciate that, Jeremy, and I'm glad you see the value on our end. But
for sure.
All right, that's episode
20
with Jeremy. Take it easy, Jeremy.
All right, bye-bye.